from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning, a recent study of massive open online university courses found that only about 4% of the million users tracked actually completed their courses. And earlier this year, San Jose State suspended its online courses after poor results, including one math class where fewer than a quarter of the students got a passing grade. We'll discuss the future of online classes. That's next here on KQED after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. A recently released University of Pennsylvania study on universities of a million users reveals that controversial massive open online courses, or MOOCs as they are called, have few active users and only about 4% who actually finish the online courses. And the study also points to the fact that those who feel that they are engaged by the courses declines much, especially after a week or two of taking the courses. In this opening hour, we want to look at the recent study, focus our attention on the future of MOOCs, and joining us from the University of Pennsylvania is Laura Perna, who's professor of higher education at the Graduate School of Education. She also is co-director of the Alliance for Higher Education and Democracy, AHED, as it's called, at University of Pennsylvania, and co-author of the recent study on MOOCs. And Laura Perna, good to have you on Forum. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Glad to have you. What did we learn from this study about, let's just go right to the core here, in terms of the success of MOOCs?
Well, so our study looked at the first generation of MOOC or Coursera courses that were offered at the University of Pennsylvania by Penn faculty during the first year, so those that were offered from June 2012 through June 2013. We had 16 courses that ran and completed over that period. We found a few things. So one, a large number of people touched these courses with variations across the different courses. As you just said, a small percentage of those persisted to the end as we measured persistence. So one of the challenges of the studies was try to understand what does movement through a course look like? What are the ways that would in which users touch these courses, what are the ways they engage in the courses, and begin to think about what are the right measures for understanding the success of these courses.
Well, you did discover a few things that I think are revelatory, and we're going to have a couple of people with us to talk about the future of MOOCs who are here in studio. But the lower the workload, the fewer the assignments, the more completions, first of all. I mean, that's kind of an equation that you discovered.
Yes. So One of the things that we tried to do with the data that we have is to try to understand how the movement of users through these courses varies based on different course characteristics. One thing that did seem to make a difference was the onus or the number of expectations on the users. So those that had fewer homework assignments, for example, had somewhat higher persistence rates.
And even though there were only 16 courses, there were a million users. So this is, well, maybe a small sample in terms of courses, but not certainly where users are concerned. But there were differences in terms of what they were being prepared for, as I understand. I mean, if they were taking courses for personal enrichment or occupational skills, there was far, well, dramatic differences than, say, college prep course.
Right. So we're very interested, and one of the things that we hope to look at as we continue on with this line of research is to try to understand just some of the variation in these courses. I think one thing that we haven't done a good job as a community so far is understanding how MOOCs may have differential impact given different types of goals. So, you know, I think that there's one area of potential impact with regard to college preparation and college-related courses. There may be a second type of impact and experience for those who are taking MOOCs for occupationally related reasons. And then a third category that has to do with what users are experiencing and what they expect when they take a course for personal enrichment.
There's also a distinction, isn't there, in those who had a degree or had some familiarity with lectures or college education as opposed to those who did not?
So this was those results refer, I believe, to a study that was released also at Penn by Zeke Emanuel. They did a survey of the users of the Coursera courses here at Penn and found that, yes, those who participated in the courses and returned the survey had higher levels of education.
And this has been certainly touted, MOOCs originally as a kind of revolution in education. Any conclusions from your study or Zeke Emanuel's study as far as, well, what the future of these ought to be? I know you were trying to do pure research here, but in terms of what you can extrapolate from it.
Well, I think that the jury's still out on what the contribution could be. I became interested in these issues because my research focuses on how to improve college access and success and opportunity for education, especially for communities that are not well served in, by our traditional forms of education. Some have pointed to MOOCs and other types of innovations as a potential approach to reach some of these communities. We don't have evidence in our study that that's happening, in part because the courses that are being that we've looked at were not really designed to achieve that type of purpose. These courses were initiated by faculty and focus on particular areas of interest. I think part of the challenge with the research and what we need to know as a community more is how courses are being designed, what the particular goals of the instructors are, what the goals of the users are. Until we have a better understanding of that, it's hard to have to know how good our measures of success are.
Again, Laura Perna is professor of higher education at the University of Pennsylvania Graduate School of Education, co-director of AHEAD, the Alliance for Higher Education and Democracy, and also co-author of the recent study on MOOCs. And good to have you with us. Thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
Let me tell you who else is joining us here. A lot of the experimental work on MOOCs locally was done at San Jose State, and there were concerns there that we'll hear about in terms of what Laura Perna mentioned vis-a-vis different class differences and racial differences and the like. Peter Hadrius is here. He's department chair in philosophy at San Jose State University. Good morning. Welcome.
Thank you. Very happy to be here.
Good to have you here. And also Sebastian Thrun is here with us back on Forum, founder and CEO of Udacity, a company that offers a university-level education to the public. And he's part-time research professor at Stanford and also a Google fellow. Welcome, Sebastian Thrun.
It's great to be back.
Good to have you. And let me go to you first here, because there's been, a lot of writing in the New York Times about, I guess, what you call the morphing of MOOCs. They keep using the word pivot, which is a word we used about moving toward Asia, let's say, economically. But there's, in other words, suggestion of some changes in terms of what you conceived originally.
Yeah, the basic concept is being refined. People might remember about 2 years ago, I took a class at Stanford Online to find 160,000 students signing up for it and 23,000 students finishing. This was Stanford AI class. And they kind of started the kind of the MOOC enthusiasm in the country and also the MOOC concerns. But since the process and the teaching has been refined a lot, and we always puzzled by exactly the same data that Laura reports, which is the finishing rates were very, very low. In fact, they were often in the single-digit percentage. And we didn't feel this was a great solution for an education problem. But we also found that the typical person enrolling in our classes is a person who's a more advanced person, typically a little bit older, and often very computer literate. So very few people come to MOOCs that are not very computer literate. And many of them look for jobs. We've done work with the university setting. We've done work with San Jose State, obviously, to bring in students into college. We've done work with Georgia Tech, where we were able to cut the cost of a degree down to 15% where it is today, which is a master's degree in computer science. But we also work with local companies such as Google and NVIDIA and Autodesk and Cloudera and many others to make courses that really prepare for workforce readiness. And those tend to be the most popular courses we have.
Bottom line, though, is not meeting the expectations you had. I mean, I don't want to suggest that it was overhyped or anything along those lines, though that's certainly what people are saying. But it's not meeting expectations in the classroom.
It's certainly meeting my expectations, because my expectation was I knew that I was in for a journey to figure out how to make it work. We're now at a point where our real pass rates parallel those you find on campus at about something like 10% of the cost. And we've done this in the summer. We did a pilot with San Jose. We did two pilots. One has been quoted a lot, which is the first one, which wasn't very good. But the second one, we actually got a 71% pass rate, the exact same you would get on campus. So we're making progress. But anybody who thinks that within like the first attempt you get it right in education is probably too optimistic. It's hard work. You iterate, you innovate, you think forward, you refine, you look at your data, and you make it better next time.
You retweak and you, in some ways, maybe even reinvent parts of it. I understand that. But and there's still a potential, I want to get you on record about this, for these to do good at the university education level. I mean, you've raised the bar probably in terms of online learning with this, and ready to learn from your mistakes is what I'm hearing.
It's going, in my opinion, my personal opinion, really, really well, and we're really very innovative. So we have this wonderful program for people to advance themselves in technology, and one of the incarnations is a master's program with Georgia Tech, where, as I said, we only charge $6,600 in tuition, very low tuition. And what we find is the people applying for this are very different from the demographics you'd find in regular college. They're about 10 years older than normal master's students, and they're almost exclusively U.S. students, as opposed to most master's students at Georgia Tech are drawn internationally. They come to the country and take master's degree education to get a visa and entry into the country. We are really reaching a segment of the population that can benefit from education and currently doesn't partake in education. People who work, people who are in jobs and want to further themselves and get the technology skills necessary to stay on top.
Sebastian Thrun, again, is founder and CEO of Udacity. Peter Hadrias is a department chair of philosophy at San Jose State University, where I guess two pilot programs there, Professor Hadrias. And, Michael Sandel's name kept coming up, yes. Harvard professor who has been on this program. And let's talk about that, because he was talking to Harvard students. He was saying, you know, you're from elite backgrounds, privileged. I mean, that just didn't hit home at San Jose State.
No, it didn't. And the philosophy department wrote an open letter to him. It was the whole department that endorsed it. In fact, there were two faculty members that largely drafted it, Professor Karine Brown and Professor Rita Manning, but it was from the philosophy department as a whole. I'd like to clarify a few things because it seems to me that there's oftentimes issues that are left out in the enthusiasm about online teaching in general and MOOCs. And, of course, MOOCs applies to massive open online courses.
Which means large scale.
Large scale. And when we were talking about the course that you mentioned, Michael, from Sandel, that would be a flip course because this is a smaller course. But the first few things that I wanted to mention, if I may, Sebastian mentioned the improvement from the first pilot to the second. But the database was quite different. The first, as he's nodding his head now, and he certainly knows very well, the first database were people who were students who oftentimes needed remedial work. They were not as savvy in terms of computers, and certainly they didn't have the kind of discipline that you would expect from a student who had maybe had been in university for 4 years and certainly one who had graduated.
And forgive me, there was a kind of digital divide. Some of them didn't have access to computers.
And in fact, there was a difficulty in actually having computers, and that was unfortunate. But the second pilot was quite a different collection of students, and that needs to be made clear. Yes, the numbers were better. The success was certainly higher percentages, but they were different students. They were students who had already had degrees. They were students who already had done quite a bit of – and, of course, if there seems to be any overall pattern so far – and the whole picture changes all the time – but it is that students who are – beginning students, more remedial students, they're going to have problems. Students who already have degrees that take MOOCs or, for that matter, flip courses because they have a love for modern poetry or they have a love for, differential equations, they do much better. This seems to be something that is a pattern we have so far. So that, in terms of those two pilots, it's not fair to say that they were tweaked and we had success rates. The database was changed.
But isn't this really the core of what has been the problem all along, that this may work in some classroom instances with some content, obviously much better than it does in other courses and other content?
Well, my background, and I'm the chair of the philosophy department, and I think that philosophy, it's such a small field, but I think it's one that's particularly not amicable to online courses and MOOCs. And I don't want to dwell on why that is, but I want to say something, and I have great respect for Michael Sandel, but I have something that I'm going to read here, which has left me just nonplussed. I mean, his course was something that was some pressure for us to teach, and he actually said in the Harvard Crimson, and this is in October 31st, to have students watch online, this is about his own course, and I'm quoting him, to have students watch online lectures in advance would risk dampening the spontaneous, unpredictable, and open-ended quality of the discussions we have in the Sanders Theater being at Harvard University. Now, he's not only saying he's not for MOOCs, he's saying he doesn't want it to be even an electronic textbook, and that is, in a sense, the most invasive technology.
So one has to ask why Michael Sandel is teaching a MOOC or doing a MOOC.
Well, I you tell me. I mean,
I'll ask him next time he's on, believe me.
He thinks that it's bad pedagogy. So why are – I mean, I guess we just don't count at San Jose State and in a lot of places like San Jose State.
Well, let me talk with Sebastian about the pedagogy because I was reading Stanford professor Susan Holmes who's saying the part of the what you get out of the classroom is the experience of working – and I know you've tried mentors and you've had students in these MOOC courses talk to each other and other kinds of innovations of that sort with the tweaking of it. But that, there's something about the classroom experience that can't be duplicated in the virtual experience or online, and it simply doesn't pedagogically hold up.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, a lot of agreement to our pilots. The demographics are different. It's been taken into account, and it's very hard to draw conclusions at this early stage. And we are learning. We're really improving. We're making it better. But to your question about the difference in pedagogy, a lot of the public debate focuses on, is this a replacement for the classroom? And I think that's the wrong question to ask. I mean, today we have television, and many people thought television is replacement for radio. But every one of your listeners right now is listening to radio, and I love radio. I love your show. It's not a replacement. The movies aren't replacement of theater. They're just very different. They reach different people. So we can reach people that never been reached before. And we have a lot of data that the dominant part of our students are actually students who would not partake in education. And they enjoy the convenience of being able to learn at home at their own pace and the reach that we have. It's just a different medium. And when people realize it's a different medium, then they're going to realize that the educational market is actually so much bigger than they thought it was. We reach people mostly they would never sign up for a college degree, and they still use us to use Udacity to advance their skills and get or upkeep a career in technology and do this very successfully. I would also say in regards to philosophy, I find it very hard to imagine having a great philosophy online course or a MOOC. And we never attempted to do it, and we probably never will, because to me, I actually taken philosophy classes when I was young. To me, philosophy is all about the discourse. It's about the moment. It's about the interaction. And that's something we can't do with a computer very well. It's much easier to do something in the area of computer science, where maybe your feedback is your program running correctly or not. I don't want to belittle computer science, but so much more is mechanically gradable and mechanically open to feedback in a more mathematical discipline than it is in a humanities discipline.
So it may be foolish to think you can use the same tools for all subjects, or for that matter, that this is an either-or, that you either have online teaching in lieu of regular classroom type of teaching that we're used to.
Yeah, and if you look at the public debate, be it New York Times, be it a Fast Company, it's all focused on this one question, are we replacing existing education? And the answer is absolutely no way. We're going to augment it. We're going to increase this reach, and we're going to invent new forms that will reach new people. And that's happening massively right now. Laura, in the beginning, mentioned that about 80% or so of the students at UPenn were students with advanced degrees. We found the same thing. Over the summer, we offered remedial math and elementary statistics, and we found that about 50% of students already had a college degree, a four-year college degree or better. That was a big surprise to us. We're actually really reacting to this, and we're learning from it every day.
But there is this sense, Peter Hedreas, that, initially when these pilot programs went on at San Jose, that maybe this would be a way to cut through the high expense of education.
Oh, very much so. And this was the this extraordinary hope that was voiced by our governor and high political individuals in the California, and I'm sure in lots of other places. But there again, I think that some of the story isn't being told. I mean, the motivation was very much to be able to deliver excellent education for less money. But one example which has been touted as a success, and this is back to San Jose State, but it's not philosophy. It's a course that's taught by Professor Khosrow Gadiri, and it's in circuits. It's in engineering. And this has been talked about very much as here it is a success. It so happened that I had the great opportunity to spend some time with Professor Gadiri because he was being interviewed by the Chronicle of Higher Education, and I was part of that. And he said that as a matter of fact, he did not think the numbers, as it turned out, success of the course is much greater. Instead of having a 60% pass rate, they had 90%, given the course was a flip course. Okay, but what has not been talked about, and our administration has, as I say, been saying this course is such a success, is what he actually said. He said he spent 80 hours a week in preparation. And this is what he said. He actually said it a few times. And he said he didn't think that the course could possibly be the success were it not that he spent so much personal time well, in effect, personalizing the course. So it was a flip course. It came from MIT, but even so, he said it would fail if he weren't there. So in answer to the question, are we saving money, you know, the future, please understand, the philosophy department, nobody is a Luddite. We're all for, you know, developing things technologically, but I think that all of the sort of the cards need to be on the table. This was a more expensive course. As it turns out, you have to pay for the flip course and you have to pay for the intense instruction for it to work. That's the way it is now.
Well, let's get back just for a moment, though, to pedagogy. I don't want to necessarily set this up as an either-or or make it into a Luddite thing, but there are those who are critical of this kind of pedagogy who say, for example, there was a University of Virginia study which says it's like the difference between watching golf and playing golf, which doesn't mean necessarily you can't do both. Or somebody else said it's like trying to think you have a social life through Facebook as opposed to a real social life. I mean, sure. As a philosopher, are those your kinds of concerns or not?
Well, I am somewhat hesitant to speak of philosophy because it's not a large subject. But in philosophy, as Sebastian, if I may, pointed out, it's somewhat of a specialized field. I mean, our, as it were, patron saint is Socrates. And, you know, it's interesting that Socrates never got any answers to questions. And
the Socratic method is the antithesis of, you know, just seeing something online, right? You back and forth, question and answer.
Yeah. But that's philosophy. I mean, the idea of philosophy, it's more along
that's
the
traditional
line.
Teaching, too.
Well, yes, but it counts, if I can put it kind of just quickly, as a mental skill. I mean, it's developing sharper critical thinking. It's developing a dedication to looking for the truth, all these things we're trying to do. That's not content. When I had a chance to speak with Andrew Ng of Coursera, he said there are three things that we do. We deliver what we wanted in education, to deliver content, number two, to be able to socialize people, number three, to provide networking. And he said Coursera courses have only been able to do one. And I thought that sounds good until I realized he's referring to education as content. That may work for some areas, but does it work for modern poetry? Does it work for it doesn't work for philosophy.
It doesn't work a lot for the humanities, which are in decline in enrollment anyway. But we have a subject for another day and one that we took up here on Forum in another hour.
Sure.
But I would like to hear from those of you listening to us, not only about what your response is to online education in the broader sense, but we're talking really about what has been characterized as a major change and a major shift. Major is putting it mildly, potentially for what is traditional university education, and what you see as the future of these massive open online courses. Should they serve, in a sense, in conjunction with traditional education, as essentially Sebastian Thrun has said, or are they going to supplant, replace? Do they have to be seen in a different light or in a different context? I'll put the question out to you as listeners, and also you may simply want to join the conversation. If you do, you can do that now. Our toll-free number is available to you. It's 866-733-6786. Again, you can join us toll-free now at 866-733-6786 or email us, forum@kqed.org. And certainly like to hear from some of you who have had experiences with MOOCs, Massive Open Online Courses. You can also go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and join us that way, or tweak us. Go to Twitter and tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. Again, we're talking with Sebastian Thrun, who is Google Vice President and Fellow and part-time research professor at Stanford, founder of Udacity, and Peter Andreas, who's chair of the philosophy department at San Jose State University. We'll hear from you when we return on Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Educators and companies involved in online education are reevaluating the future of online education in light of a number of recent studies, particularly a study that was done out of the University of Pennsylvania. And we heard one of the co-founders or co-authors of that study, Laura Perna, heard from her earlier. With us for this hour, Peter Andreas, who is department chair in philosophy department at San Jose State University, and Sebastian Thrun, who is founder and CEO of Udacity and also a Google vice president. And we're going to go to your calls and emails. Again, you can join us by phone, Toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or by email, forum@kqed.org, or go right to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. I'm going to go to you, our listeners, just a second here, but I want to come back to you, Sebastian Thrun. What are you seeing then, really? I mean, I know there's been kind of a what's been described as a pivot, rethinking all that, maybe moving more into vocational education or corporate education. Not sure what corporate education means, but I guess vocational largely. What do you see about the future of this, though, in terms of particularly those students who are, well, presently not necessarily getting the kind of higher education they want or can't afford it?
Look, we're facing a massive skills gap that is widening. At this point in time, there's 2 to 3 million open positions in the United States in the tech sector. McKinsey believes by 2020, it'll be 85 million positions worldwide that need skilled labor. You can see when Walmart opens a store, you get more applications for unskilled labor, and they're desperately looking for great software engineers. When I talk to CEOs of major companies, they're all extremely frustrated about the widening skills gap. And it's not just people coming straight out of college, out of high school. It's people throughout their career, people in their 40s and 50s that need to adjust to the new skills needed. The reason why major corporations in the Valley are really tossing money at us to build courses with them is because they want to see this addressed. They want people to have the right skills when they hit the workforce. And these skills often are somewhat vocational type skills. They're really skills to be able to solve problems, to be able to write software. We recently launched with Cloudera and MongoDB and a number of other companies, Facebook included, a track on data sciences. There's a huge need for people getting a data science education and understand how to deal with big data. We're working on a web and mobile track, partially with Google, turns out, to give people skills to be able to do mobile programming and to be able to either create their own existence and own corporations or join companies just like Google. And that specific gap is really massive, and it's widening, and it's really hard to see that how we can solve this without a new form of education. Most of our Udacity students are people who would want to stay at home, who have a family, who have kids, who have a mortgage to carry, and can't take off 2 or 3 or 4 or 6 years, whatever it takes to get a college degree, and really want to get very quickly, very fast, the type of skill that gets them into jobs. We have found people that really were able to take a Udacity class or two and find amazing new jobs in new corporations. We've had people move from work in the food industry all the way to becoming a programmer and data analyst at major corporations. We have AT&T as a partner. Out of AT&T, 500 employed people, engineers, actually applied for admissions into the master's degree we're doing with Georgia Tech, which are all skills focused and knowledge focused courses.
Well, let me cut to the chase here. Does this mean that you're de-emphasizing this in lieu of, say, university courses in the humanities, philosophy, or for that matter, as in lieu of a college or getting a college degree through online learning?
So Udacity never really did humanities. We never really had humanities classes, and we stayed away from it for many reasons. One is I find it really hard to imagine how to do a great philosophy class online or a great English class online. We find it much easier to do a great class online on how to become a data scientist and how to be proficient with data. And we believe in the Socratic method. If you look at Udacity's materials, we don't record professors. We don't put lectures online. We put exercises online. Almost all of our classes are driven by projects, and the way we assess students is by original project work. They really come up with new stuff, and our people assess them. It's a very different mode from what you think MOOCs might be if you look in the MOOC world. It's not just the recorded lectures.
Well, actually, I think we have, as our first caller, Adrian from Saratoga, who took one of the Udacity courses at San Jose State. Hi, Adrian.
Hello.
Yes, sir. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you. So I took the computer science course over the summer with San Jose State, and it was one of the best experiences I've ever had with the class. I loved the projects. I learned a lot. Today, my friends who are taking the equivalent course asked me for help because it was such a good experience. And I just wanted to say thank you for one of the best learning experiences I've ever had.
Can you tell us why it was so good as opposed to a traditional classroom, or was it good in ways that a traditional classroom might have offered as well?
Well, the thing was, whenever I had a problem or question, there's always someone there to answer it, which was really helpful. When there was a concept I couldn't grasp, I could just click a button and say, "What? How do I do something?" And there'd be someone there to talk with me any hour of the day.
Okay, I thank you for the call. Peter Hadrius, response from you.
Well, I'm wondering, if I may, can I address something to Adrian?
Yeah.
First off, Adrian, can you tell me what year you are at San Jose State?
I'm a sophomore.
A sophomore. And the course again?
It was a CS46A, an intro to Java.
All right. Well, I mean, what you're saying speaks for itself. of course, teaching Java is not comparable to teaching a course in the humanities and the arts. I mean, there are certain courses that has been established, I think, in this hour that are going to be more conducive. But congratulations on your success.
And thank you, Adrian. We'll go right to another caller, and that's David. David, you're on.
Hi. I'm a teacher. I work for Ocean Grove Charter School, which is a school that works with home-based high school independent studies learners. And I just want to say, while online learning can be beneficial for people with particular learning styles, there's a majority of people that find it not enjoyable and not conducive to promoting real intellectual development or learning how to innovate, which is really the future of the economy. And also related to the of learning, I would say the majority of the students I work with that use online programs do not really enjoy them. They find them dry. And as supplements, I think they're very beneficial, or for learning strictly mechanistic knowledge like computer science. And actually, computer science, even on the higher level, I would say it has, you know, of course, great limitations. I appreciate some aspects of online learning, but I just want to emphasize what I've experienced as a teacher as its very, very clear limitations.
All right, David, thank you. There you have, you know, two almost diametrically opposed views, as one might expect when it comes to this. Let's hear from some more of our listeners. Ron, you're on. Hi.
Hi. I'm hearing this. My experience with the University of the World Education Conference in San Diego in the 1990s, I went instead of a fellow board member, Prince Alfred von Liechtenstein, and there they had a fellow from London by the name of Lord Perry. He had in Taiwan 400,000 distance learning students, and now we've so evolved that now that we have that, that's free in education. I look at college-bound students and other generationals that would take an interest but need a preparatory course, a short course, to introduce them to the subject, possibly, and give them that fulfillment, whether they can take and master the course itself. Some kind of energy to help those who may not be college-bound would be a great contribution to society.
All right. I thank you for the call. Sebastian Thurn, want to come in?
Yeah, I mean, that's largely what we aspire to do at Udacity. We really change the demographics of students that can really access high-quality education. I specifically, of course, loved Adrian's report on our introduction to computer science class. It's one of the many computer science classes that we teach. And what we've done at Udacity is we really understand how important it is to have a person helping students when they get lost or motivating them. And we really changed the MOOC formula to be much, much richer, to really have people on the ground to assist. And as a result, we now find that our completion rates are not 4 or 5 or 6% anymore. They're like 60% or 90%.
Peter Hadrius. Let's get you on record here.
In relationship to what?
To the comments from the caller and to what Sebastian just said.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this certainly is the issue of the particular course involved. But I appreciate Adrian's comment, and it speaks for itself. However, what he did say is that, you know, all he had to do press a button and he got a response. And there was a very strong mentoring of some sort that was going on. Now, I just wonder about the numbers. If you have a MOOC, I mean, a bona fide MOOC that involves sort of 1,000 students, are you able to produce mentoring of that type of quality? I'm wondering whether this isn't something of a lead that's taking place. But how is it possible, if you have 1,000 students, to be able to enable those 1,000 students to just press a button and get, you know, immediate response? I just find that to be, practically speaking, hard to understand.
I think that's a question to you, Sebastian Thrun.
Well, the short answer is we've done this. In fact, we've done it with San Jose State. Over the summer, we had over 2,000 students sign up, and you just heard one of them on the radio being luckily very, very, very positive. And it turns out we're doing the same thing with Georgia Tech and all our classes now, where people can get access to those mentors that we have, and they're really amazing people. And the immediate ability to get help and get feedback on your project, on your coding example, makes, in my opinion, all the difference in education, the way we administer it. The nice thing about this, really interesting, is the San Jose State pilot over the summer, we charge each student $150. And we did this with the type mentoring that Adrian just attested as was a positive experience. Now, if you compare this to the existing costs that you'd find in colleges, they're much, much higher. And so an out-of-state tuition for the same kind of class would run about 10 times as much. And we have applied the same formula to Georgia Tech, where we've been able to cut the cost of an entire degree down to about 15% where it is today, and really focus on an efficient delivery of mentoring and of content and everything together to make a great educational experience. Now, the word is still out there whether it's successful. It's an experiment. We're trying this out. We believe there's an enormous need for workforce readiness. We believe there's an enormous number of people who want jobs and get the skills necessary to find those jobs in the tech space. But we're certainly able to meet these economics.
I'm sorry. Did you have something you wanted to add, Peter?
Well, I'm wondering about, as you say, it was $150, but I'm wondering just in terms of the way in which the costs worked. You were able to produce this course for $150 a piece and still maintain that amount of employees and the production of the course. Something doesn't quite add up for me.
So when you go in and look at the costs of education, I think that's one of the nice things that this new medium brings us. It's not just reach and access that you can do it at home at your own leisure, but also when you really distill down what's the cost of services rendered in this new medium that we're developing in Udacity, it turns out not to be $1,500 a class. It turns out to be much cheaper. And that's one of the points where I think our governor got very excited, and many people do, because we had an escalation of college costs. We have enormous college debt. We reached a $1 trillion college debt. We have 10% default rate on college loans right now. The average college debt per student is about $30,000 at this point. And I believe it's very risky to release young people into society with a $30,000, $50,000, $100,000 debt. On top of it, what we find is that the value of a college degree has been going down. Students right now, as just found in an independent study by, forgot the name of the university, George Washington University, I believe, that the time it takes between college degree and employment is now more than a year. And that means that it's kids, like they move out of the house to the college just to move back into their parents' house, as Colbert just recently said. I think that's something we should really work on and focus on to understand how to get efficient education, also make it more affordable for people.
Let me bring in more of our callers. We want to go to Mountain View, and Ian joins us. Good morning, Ian.
Good morning. I just wanted to say a few things. One, I was involved in developing a MOOC on crowdfunding, so kind of a more entrepreneurial subject, and one that is emerging and not really addressed by traditional universities. And so that's one area where I feel they can be very helpful, is adapting very quickly to the educational needs. And then the other thing that I've found with friends that have four-year degrees, but also people that have no post-secondary education, is that MOOCs can really give you confidence as an introduction to more four-year material. And so they don't really supplant it, but they may give you the foundational skills that help you go back to school and get new skills. And so it's not quite the same thing.
Let me ask Peter Hedreas to respond to that. I mean, the idea that it can enhance a regular baccalaureate education or add to it.
There are many ways in which the combination could work well. I'm for that. But can I address Sebastian's previous comment? I mean, could you, if you would, do you honestly think it is possible to offer a course such as the course that was offered to Adrian on Java for $150 in future? A lot of money has been thrown at this from many sources, so that $150 is very suspect in terms of just what it costs to produce. You have to produce a course. You have to pay the mentors and all the rest of that in order to have this. Can it be done for $150?
It's been a whole question about MOOCs from the beginning. How much can it be monetized and where's
the... And the answer is an unconditional, uncompromising yes. We do the same right now with companies like Salesforce and courses that are more procured by industry. And the basic formula is the following. You have to produce a certain amount of content. The course would not go without content. That's often referred to as the MOOC content. And that is often actually sponsored by third parties. We get actually companies to give us money to make these content available for free to the world. And we make it available for free to everybody. So it's basically, if you just want to have access to the content, it's even free at this point. But then the amount of mentoring that we find in the summer pilot, for example, was roughly in the order between 3 and 6 hours per student per course. It wasn't actually that much. And the reason why it wasn't that much is being there at the right time, and when a student gets stuck, doesn't mean you have to spend hours and hours with that same student. Many students ask the same question. Like if you have 100,000 students, you know, you don't get 100,000 different questions. And you can actually really amortize that part of the experience and make your mentors really efficient. And this is real data. This is not just hypothetical. We actually did it. We offered those courses. And we're leveraging this now into a $6,600 master's degree in computer science that normally costs $45,000.
All right. We're getting a lot of comments. I want to read some of them, both pro and con. Jenny writes on our Facebook page, I teach online classes and I love them. I structure them in a very intentional way so they are not formulas, so that each week students have the opportunity to shape the conversations. Each assignment is individual, scholarly, and collaborative. And above all, each aspect of the course encourages and requires critical thinking and rigorous reading and writing, not clicking a mouse or passive listening. I love it. Another pro comment from David, who emailed us, though not an endorsement of teaching philosophy online, I can imagine a successful online course in philosophy. And for what it's worth, I say this from two professional perspectives, namely that of a philosophy instructor and a user experience designer. Whatever the online course, if it is failing, it may be failing because of its form. That is, because of the bad experience it presents. And a web comment from Ben. I've taken multiple free classes from iTunes University, which has numerous Stanford classes, and love it. I get bored easily in lecture hall, so being able to watch the lectures in double speed is great. Plus, I can rewind or slow down when things get difficult. Thanks for all the hard work these guys have been putting in. And yet another pro comment by email from Joseph. Isn't the main point about higher education the cost? These disruptive technologies dangle the possibilities of receiving an elite university's bachelor degree for perhaps $10,000. MOOCs will eventually do more for social justice and income inequality than any government program could ever dream of. On the other side of the ledger, Mark emails us. Let me suggest a hypothesis to test. If a student hasn't completed reading a book in the last few years, particularly a nonfiction book, they'll have a tough time with a MOOC. Another con point. Tony writes, I teach at San Jose State. When I presented the MOOC issue to the students, they basically said, great, my textbook talks to me. Where's my professor? Another con item from a listener named Laura who writes, I'm enrolled in a MOOC through Coursera now, and I definitely agree that the students who come with the most knowledge benefit most from the course. At the beginning, the class forums were filled with questions from students who struggled on problem sets and asked basic questions such as how to use Excel or code. Now we are 7 weeks into the course, and the only questions I see on the forum seem to be coming from students with an advanced understanding of the material who are looking for a more sophisticated discussion of the course. As a student who falls in between, I find it difficult to find other students on my level who have basic skills but are not experts to discuss course content with. And here's a question from Anita, who says, it seems to me that online degrees are seen as inferior, less rigorous, not real by the general public. And what do the potential employers think of online education? Well, we've been talking about that directly to some extent with Sebastian Thrun, but it does have a kind of subaltern role in many people's minds. Like if you have to go online for your sheepskin, it's not going to have as much value. That's a hill to climb too, a mountain maybe.
Well, what we find at Udacity that employers are coming to us and say, we want to make the internal training that we do with our own engineers available through Udacity. Facebook is a good example. We're launching a data science class with them. You can sign up right now. And it's the class that Facebook engineers are taking internally to go up to speed in data sciences. And they want the world to know this. Now, whether they eventually believe our credentials is to some extent an open question. We've got a lot of interest from industry. We have a lot of companies signed up that use our materials as a way to train their own workforce. But they also, lots of our students with our credentials have found jobs in places like Google and Amazon and Apple. It's actually going quite well. The reason why this is going so well, in my opinion, is the skills gap. There is a very strong perceived skills gap. So McKinsey did a study. 56% of employers believe that students even leaving college with a recent degree don't have the right skills to be successful in the workplace. And that's exactly where Udacity comes in. With our classes with these leading industry companies, we can get you those skills that you need to be successful in the workplace.
Fascinating question for you, Peter Hidreus, from a listener tweeted to us, a listener named Will, who says, would philosophy be better introduced to many if we created a Socrates-like question-asking artificial intelligence?
That's a good one. Well, I mean, I don't know. I am tempted to make a pitch for philosophy, if you will forgive me. But in this talk about, you know, getting jobs, et cetera, and let me make my pitch, and please forgive me for this. As it turns out, philosophy majors get the highest overall cumulative in LSAT tests. They get the highest overall cumulative in GRE tests. They come in second on the exam that's need to be taken for an MBA. Coming in first is mathematics, coming in third is engineering, and unfortunately, business degrees come way down the line. Now, so this business about, you know, how to get jobs, you know, at least, I'm saying a pitch for my club. But philosophy actually does very well. And in terms of preparing people for these exams that leads them to law school and these other places.
I'll say the same for my field, literature, which a lot of people don't recognize. English can be a very useful major.
And also, if I may, 1 minute, go back to something Sebastian said. When you said in terms of producing the course for $150, you said that there are various, if I'm recalling you right, there are various companies that have actually are so interested in developing these things that they're helping in the funding. Now, they're going to help funding for things like Java. They're not going to help funding for things like humanities and the arts. I've always made a pitch for philosophy as actually being useful for getting jobs or at least developing careers. What about that? I'm still stuck with, can you do it for $150? If you're getting contributions from these companies that will give you so many millions to produce it, that's not...
So I'm actually, it turns out, a big fan of humanities and a big fan of philosophy and I'm a big fan of interdisciplinary work. And if I critique our existing university system, one of my critiques is that we have too much packaged into silos where individuals only get to see one discipline, then get a chance to cross work among other disciplines. I believe to be successful in the workforce, we need communication skills, we need critical thinking skills, and we need an understanding of the history of this place and the thought that went behind the way we shaped up humanities and how technology interacted. In the Valley, if I critique myself in the Valley, we are often a little bit blindsided going too quickly for technologies without understanding the broader context of implications. There's nothing that we wish more than having a broadband, wonderful educational experience for our students online that involves all of this. We started with computer science because it's the most pressing area to work in, and also that's the most biggest part of the skills gap. And we ask employers what type of skills you need. They often say, we need cybersecurity skills, we need data science skills. This is probably a self-select by the employers I talk to and the people that are my circle of my friends. I think going forward, I would love to take the challenge to see what we can do for philosophy. I think it's a much harder mountain to climb because I believe the Socratic method of education is much more important in the humanities than there is in my part of the world. But I think we should try it. We should experiment. We should really understand, can we use these media to our advantage and be open-minded about it. I called part of our education is lousy. When we had like 4% finishing rate, I'm on record to call it lousy. And the reason why I call it lousy is I want to be honest about it. I want to establish an honest dialogue about what works, what doesn't work. And I want to establish a space where we can experiment with these things rather than shying away and very quickly judging something as non-working.
And you also say in the New York Times something to the effect that maybe it doesn't work for some of these students who are not as educated or haven't been exposed to education in a higher sense?
We also obviously have much more students that already have advanced degrees and really looking for specific computer skills. Then we have students in the high school area that are falling behind and trying to make up. We directed a lot of our work at inner city schools, specifically on pushing off the governor and the California Faculty Association, who really recommended to us to go to inner city schools because these kids need college preparedness. And as you know, the results have been somewhat mixed. Our first pilot where we did this wasn't that great. And it was rightfully, of course, pointed out by many people that the finishing rates weren't as good. And as we changed demographics, they, of course, became better. But I think not all is lost. We are in year number two of an experimentation that should take 20 years. And I believe the answer will never be black and white. We'll always have a combination of things. But calling something a complete failure after one iteration is also not particularly smart as a society, I believe.
Let me read another email from Anne who writes, my daughter is currently a freshman enrolled at UC Davis. Her small class has 250 students. The other three have 500 to 600 students. She would be much better off with a quality online class and going to a lecture hall where the professor uses a blackboard to communicate with students. With an online class, she could do the lecture online and then go to the valuable discussion classes, only 40 to 45 students, and she would get much more out of it. And likely the lecture would be much better than what she is getting now. And you would say what to that, Peter Hadrius?
Well, I don't know that specific course, but
Huge classes now. At the
yeah, but there have been in UC for a long time, and that's my background. And we would have classes assigned, and then there would be sections. And exactly that was what was done. I mean, to have a... This caring parent is talking about something that already exists. I mean, you have large lectures and then you have sections where you have teaching assistants who discuss it oftentimes with people of 15 to 20 in the section.
We bring another caller on. Becky, that's you. Join us. Thanks for waiting.
Oh, so I think most people have said everything that I've been thinking, but I've taken classes and I've taught classes, and I think different kids do pay attention better online and other kids do pay attention, or students.
But didn't you take a hybrid class?
I took the hybrid. So I took the hybrid statistics class at Foothill College, actually, and I got 100% on all my tests, got out of it and realized I enjoyed it, but I did not understand or retain it. So then I went to Coursera and took a biostats class through Hopkins, and the guy did actually lecture online.
I wonder if hybrid is maybe the way to go here. I mean, there's a better option. You didn't find that, though, Becky.
I liked it, but I realized I didn't retain whatever, however, the online, that was most of the bulk of the exercises. I didn't retain that clicking, like that clicking thing to learn. But through the Hopkins class, I got to listen to the lectures, and something about that for me clicked. So I think it's going to be different for different people, just like regular classroom learning is.
Well, I thank you for the call, and we're coming toward the end of the hour here. Maybe just a final word from each of you. You've said you're not a Luddite here, Professor Hadreis, but at the same time, there was a failure in this at San Jose State, and what do we learn from that failure?
Well, the part of the thing, again, I mean, I guess it's my job in this hour to talk about what I think is somewhat of the unsaid, is that my situation as chair is have 1 foot in the administration, as every chair, and 1 foot in the faculty. We are because of budget problems, we are told to teach more students for less money. And the people who will be cut will be the least advantaged. They will be so-called temporary lecturers. Oftentimes they've taught for 20, 30 years, but they're temporary lecturers. And they're the ones that can be cut. These are people who are making between $25,000 to maybe $45,000 a year, sometimes teaching as many as 200 students per semester. Okay, now, why it seems to me that in terms of this mentoring business, why can't some of the money be thrown at them? Because actually, I mean, now we can develop online as well.
We've got seconds left. Sebastian Thorne, can you answer that quickly?
I think there's a great future ahead of us looking into specifically the skills gap, where we have the most students right now, people trying to find jobs. And I would recommend everybody try out Udacity.com. We're joining 1.6 million students, and many of them have found jobs through us already.
Thank you, Sebastian Thrun. Thank you, Peter Hadreis. And thank you, our listeners. Another hour up ahead, former Chief Justice Ron George will be joining us to talk about his judicial career and the future of justice in California. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.